Speaking of history lessons, it's always interesting to me because there are times when I'm preparing to teach a lesson that a life circumstance connects with the lesson. I mean, Rocky and I plan months ahead what texts we're going to do, and we put a teaching calendar together, and so we know. Now, we'll tweak that on occasion, but we pretty much know what Sunday we're going to teach and what the text is that we're going to teach on. So I chuckled this particular week as I concluded my process of study for this lesson, because our lesson is about the death of Sarah and the purchase of her burial plot. Well, over the last month, I've conducted two funerals. So I chuckled a little bit to think, okay, that's appropriate. I've just done two funerals, so I'm just going to talk about one that happened thousands of years ago this morning. It's also ironic that the funeral that I conducted in Pennsylvania for my really good friend Jim, who was a mentor to literally hundreds of young students as he worked through various stages on crew staff, would use a phrase because students would say, well, give me some advice, tell me what I need to know. And one of the phrases that he always used, never miss a funeral. Never miss a funeral. We'll talk a little bit about that later on, which is also ironic because I was watching an old episode of NCIS this past week, and one of the lines on the show was this: this is life calling and leaving a voicemail. I'm short. Appreciate me. One of the things I learned early on as a pastor is that when you officiate at weddings, nobody pays any attention to what you say. When you officiate at a funeral, everybody's listening. So with all that in mind, that's my history lesson for today. Turn to Genesis chapter 22. We'll start at the end of chapter 22 and work our way through chapter 23. We need to take a quick look at the genealogy at the end of chapter 22, because this is the connection between what's going to happen next after we finish Sarah's burial. Genesis chapter 22, beginning in verse 20. Came about after these things that it was told Abraham, saying, behold, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor, Uz, his firstborn, and Buz, his brother. That's interesting anyway, but and Kemuel, the father of Aram, and Kesed, and Hazo, and Pildash, and Jedlaf, and Bethuel. Bethuel became the father of Rebekah. These eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother. Now his concubine, whose name was Rumah, also bore Teba, and Gaham, and Tahash, and Makah. And you're thinking, what in the world do all these names mean, and why is this genealogy stuck right here at the end of chapter 22 before we talk about Sarah's passing? Nahor is Abraham's brother. Remember when they left, when Terah took Abraham and the rest of the family out of Ur, the Chaldees, and they traveled to Haran, and Terah settled there. Nahor settled there, and Abraham and Lot left and traveled to what's going to become the Promised Land, a land that God said to Abraham, I'll show you, but you just don't know where it is yet. Just follow me and trust me, I'll get you there. Nahor had remained behind. Nahor has a wife, and she bore him sons. One of those sons, Bethuel, is married and has a daughter. The daughter's name is Rebekah. Why is that significant? Rebekah is going to become Isaac's wife. So the author of Genesis is transitioning us literally from the life of Abraham and Sarah to the life of Isaac and Rebekah. And this little genealogy is kind of that transition statement. But he's also beginning to answer a question that will continue to be answered as we go through the next section. And here's the question. When the recipients specifically Abraham and Sarah, because that's where he's starting. When the recipients of the promises, which are not yet fulfilled, die, not the promises, but the recipients, what happens to the promises? Because you remember, Abraham was promised a land, a seed, and a blessing. So at the ripe old age of past 100, Abraham has one son, Isaac. And Sarah dies. What's the deal here? Can't you imagine Abraham asking a question like that at this particular moment, probably putting it in a much more dignified form than I just did? But this section begins to answer that question that Abraham was asking. Now what? What about these promises? How is all this going to work out? Beyond that, and probably behind that a little bit, is a reminder that Abraham's home, where he came from, is where all of his family still lived. It was just Abraham and Sarah and now Isaac who are left here in the promised land. The rest of his family is at home. When Sarah died, there must have been an emotional tie to home, because that's where you bury people. You bury them at home. And what we discover is that despite those strong ties to home, both the author and Abraham want us to know that Abraham had enough faith in God that to believe that the promises that God made would be fulfilled in the future, because home was now Canaan. Abraham was not going home to his original birthplace. He was burying Sarah here. So with that genealogy in mind, we're in chapter 23. Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of Sarah's life. She died in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Alan Ross, in his commentary on the book of Genesis, says this at the beginning of this section, chapter 23. He says, although this chapter does not make any overt theological point, the fact that the narrator included this tradition in the book gives it theological significance. The tension arises because with the promises of many descendants and of the land yet unfulfilled, the recipients of the promise begin to die. So what then becomes of the promises? The inclusion of the genealogy of Nahor just prior to this chapter reminds the reader that the ancestral home was in the east. But the account of the burial in the land of promise informs the reader that there was no going back for Abraham. The future was in Canaan, even though the first recipients of the promise would die before the promise could be realized. The structure of this chapter is relatively simple. First two verses give us the age and the death of Sarah. Verses 3 through 18 give us the transaction between Abraham and the Hittites for the purchase of the cave at Machpelah and the burial plot for Sarah, and the chapter concludes in verses 19 to 20 with the details of Sarah's burial. The major section, verses 3 through 18, really consists of three little movements. The movements really include the negotiations between Abraham and the Hittites for the purchase of the land, and we'll look at that in a little more detail when we get to the text, but that's basically the outline. We have the first two verses, the last two verses, and the middle section in between. There are lots of accounts in Scripture of death and burial. And the vast majority of those, someone dies and they're buried. Look at Jesus as an example. He died, he was buried. Interestingly enough, in this chapter, that natural sequence, death and burial, is broken by this long section of verses about this negotiation that happens between Abraham and the Hittites for the purchase of this land. Again, as I've already mentioned, Sarah's death is recorded in the first two verses. Her burial is recorded in the last two verses. But the purchase of the cave takes 17 verses. Why would you think the author would want to do that? Why is that so important? Why is the purchase of the burial plot take so much space in the recording of what happened between the death and the burial of Sarah? So just kind of keep that question in mind, okay? What's that, Jim?
I say that's just the way lawyers do.
That's what lawyers do. Present company excluded, right, John? Sarah is the only woman that I know of whose age at death is mentioned in Scripture, which is why we as men never ask a woman, how old are you? Okay? Because if God wanted us to know, he'd tell us. She's also the only woman in Scripture whose name was changed from Sarai to Sarah. The notation of her age, among other things, illustrates her importance. Because if she is 127, how old is Isaac? 37. He was born when she was 89. So Isaac is now 37 years old. Think about this, okay, as we move on in the next section about Isaac. Abraham, we find out later on in chapter 25, died at the age of 175, 38 years after Sarah. The recipients of the promise, the original promise, are going to die without receiving the promises. Sarah was the first, but her death reminds Abraham of his mortality. He's getting older. It would have been natural, historically and practically, for Abraham to mourn the death of Sarah and then take her home for burial. It's interesting that right before I started preparation for this, while I was traveling and flying on a plane, I was reading a book entitled Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. Again, it was a book given to me by Jim. It was part of his collection. Jim was into military history, and he and I had that common, so this happened to be one of his old books that I had not read, and so I had this on my shelf. And the book details the history of what's called the Old Guard, which is the oldest active duty infantry regiment in the Army. Okay? And one of the Old Guard's major responsibilities is to conduct all of the funerals at Arlington National Cemetery. The detail of what they go through is absolutely incredible in the planning and the process of all of those. That's a whole nother story for a whole nother time. But in the very beginning, in the first 20 pages of this book, the author makes this statement. Our nation's devotion to our war dead plays out from the moment a soldier falls on the battlefield to the final note of taps. The soldier's unit works to return the remains and the personal effects to the family as quickly as possible. Casualty care and evacuation is a central part of Army training from basic to Ranger school. And once we are in theater, that is in the war zone, leaders get orientation briefings on the mortuary affairs collection point and its procedures. Thus, if a soldier is lost in combat, we already know where to transport the remains and what to do. The objective of this training is to get the remains home as quickly as possible. That throughout American history, it's always been our practice, if at all possible, to bring home those who died in combat. It's not a new practice. It's not reserved for the military. It's not a normal conversation that we have around the dinner table with friends if we're sitting around we don't usually ask, well, where's your burial plot? But for the most part, many of us have purchased or have had purchased for us burial plots in a place we call home, wherever that is, which could be here, could be in another state, could be in another city outside of Dallas, wherever home is. My dad, when he was living, purchased 5 burial plots in a little cemetery out on eastern Long Island, Sterling Cemetery in Greenport, so that he and my mom and the 3 kids would have a place to be buried. Because that was home. He was raised there, mom was raised there, his folks were raised there, so that's home. Now, I don't intend to be buried there, but that's a whole nother, again, story for another time, because that's not home for me. But anyway, it really shouldn't surprise us with all that kind of information that if Abraham were to head back to Ur or to Haran to bury Sarah, we'd expect that. After all, that was home. But what we discover is that's not what Abraham did. Instead, he purchases a burial plot in Canaan, both as an indication that that's home, but secondly, an indication that he's not going back. This is his permanent residence. The author lists for us the location of her death, Kiriath Arba, which is further defined as Hebron in the territory of Canaan. Later on in verse 19, Mamre is mentioned as well, which is also reminded is in Hebron in Canaan. The importance of those geographical notices is that now Canaan is Abraham's residence. What we next discover, however, is that Abraham is still a sojourner in Canaan, which means, basically, he owns nothing. He has no residence to set his home up in. He has no land that he owns. So hence the need to get involved in the negotiation to buy this property. Abraham says in verse 4, I'm a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight. That is, not next to me where I'm my tent. Abraham's desire to bury Sarah in the promised land, again, reminds us that Abraham has adopted Canaan as his home in light of the promises that God had given. It's really an evidence of Abraham's faith, because he owned nothing, and as of yet, he didn't own the land either. But the promise with God is, this is yours. I'm going to give all of this to you. As we read through the text, particularly verses 3 through 18, you're going to see the word dead occur over and over and over. Verse 2, verse 3, verse 4, verse 6, verse 8, verse 11, verse 13, verse 15, verse 19. In case there was any doubt that Sarah had died, the author wants you to know that Sarah is dead. And her death becomes the catalyst or the reason as to why Abraham purchases a burial plot in Canaan. God had promised the land. And since as yet he doesn't have it, his faith in God causes him to purchase a place for Sarah. For Sarah to be buried, for he to be buried, for his lineage to be buried. So again, the purchase of the land becomes evidence of Abraham's faith. Just a little bit of an aside. It's very much like us today. God's promises are not exhausted in our lifetime. Just as Abraham bought the cave in hope that the land would eventually be his and his descendants would dwell there and they would see the fulfillment of all the promises, we have a hope. We have a hope for the full benefits of the promise of our salvation beyond this life. We're not saved just for now, are we? Matter of fact, more importantly, we're saved for eternity. What God has in store for us is far greater than what we experience now. So that Paul writes at the end of the book of Philippians, our citizenship is where? Our citizenship is in heaven. And therefore, that's why we eagerly wait for the return of our Savior, who will transform the bodies of our death into glorious living examples of what God can do in a life. The best really is yet to come. And if it's really bad here, that gives you hope. If it's really good here, it ought to remind you that as good as it gets, this is as good as it's going to get here, but the best is yet to come. The interchange between Abraham and Ephron, predominantly as a representative of the Hittites, follows a common pattern that we would find if we lived in the ancient Near East. Party A offers to purchase a land, a portion of land. Party B dismisses the offer and wants to give it away. Okay? No charge. That's just what we do. Party A refuses the gift and makes another offer, which initiates the negotiation. Okay? That's just the way it is. All right? And notice that's basically how this unfolds. We're going to look at this in detail, but let me give you the overview to start with. Abraham offers to purchase property from Ephron. That's verses 3 through 9. He says, give me a specific piece of property located in a specific place in exchange for payment. This is what I want. Okay? Ephron rejects the offer to purchase the land. He says in verses 10 and 11, just take it. I give it to you. Who refuses a free gift? Anyway, Abraham once again offers to purchase the property, verses 12 to 13. And he says, I'll pay the money for the field. So the negotiation continues. Ephron answers Abraham's offer by stating a price that is exorbitantly high, 400 shekels of silver. Abraham accepts the price, pulls the money out of his money pocket in the front of the public of everybody and purchases the land. So let's look at the process in a little more detail. Abraham's request, verses 3 and 4. Abraham rose from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth, saying, I'm a stranger, I'm a sojourner. Give me a burial site among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight. Abraham has requested that the sons of Heth, the Hittites, people who lived in Canaan where he was, to provide him a place to bury Sarah. He acknowledged that the problem was his status as a stranger and a sojourner, meaning he had no property of his own on which to have a permanent burial plot. Abraham's request is taken at face value. Look at verse 5. The sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, hear us, my lord, you are a mighty prince among us. They recognized Abraham's character. They recognize his wealth among them. He was well known. You're mighty among us. Therefore, bury your dead in the choicest of our graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead. It seems that Abraham's basically just asking for a place to bury Sarah. And so the Hittites say, sure, we'll give you a place. No problem. Yeah, we'll loan this to you, basically, for a period of time. You can bury her here. A borrowed, temporary grave was not what Abraham wanted. So Abraham clarifies in verse 7, beginning of verse 7, what he wants. Abraham rose, bowed to the people of the land, the sons of Heth. He spoke with them, saying, if it is your wish for me to bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and approach Ephron the son of Zohar for me, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns, which is at the end of his field, for the full price. Let him give it to me in your presence for a burial site. Abraham wants to make sure that his intentions are clearly understood. He desired a permanent possession, not a borrowed tomb. The land of Canaan was to be his home, not a mere stopping off place. Consequently, Abraham asked the people to urge Ephraim to sell him the cave of Machpelah, which was at the end of his field in this specific place, in this specific land. It was not to be a gift. It was to be the purchase at the full value of the property. He wasn't trying to cheat him. He wasn't trying to shortchange him. He said, whatever price you, that's fair price, I'll pay it so that it becomes mine. The agreement is reached. Verse 10. Ephraim was sitting among the sons of Heth. And Ephraim the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth, even of all who went in at the gate of the city. Because you know at the gate of the city, that's where business is conducted. So here you have the elders and the leaders of the city, and they're conducting business, and Abraham is there purchasing this land. Ephraim is there, and he says, no, my lord, hear me. I'll give you the land. I'll give you the cave that is in it. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you to bury your dead. Abraham bowed before the people of the land. He spoke to Ephraim in the hearing of the people of the land, saying, if you will only please listen to me. You've been there, right? Where someone has repeated back what you said. You know that's not what you said. You said, no, listen to me. That never happens in your marriage, I know, but it happens in mine. But listen to me. That's not what I said. And Abraham says, now listen to me. I will give the price of the field. Accept it from me that I may bury my dead there. Abraham wants him to know that he wants to purchase the land for a permanent burial place. So Ephraim answered Abraham, saying to him, my lord, listen to me. Okay, if that's what you want. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver. What is that between me and you? So bury your dead. Abraham listened to Ephraim, and Abraham weighed out for Ephraim the silver which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, commercial standard. That is a known, this was acceptable process of meal of income, not income, but exchange. So Ephraim's field, which was in Machpelah, which faced Mamre, the field and the cave which was in it, and all the trees which are in the field that were within all the confines of the border were deeded over to Abraham for a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth before all who went in at the gate of the city. The price is set. Abraham pays it. There's almost a background to some of this that is foreign to me, but in reading what other people have written about this in terms of what's happening, you recognize that Ephraim's nobody's fool. Because he says, if you really want to pay for it, well, it's really going to cost you. I'm going to charge you top dollar for this field. He places a value on what he initially wanted to give as a gift. And it accomplishes two things, really. It names the price, but in such a way, because I wanted to give it to you as a gift, it almost makes it impossible for Abraham to renegotiate. Because if Ephraim is so generous to offer it as a gift, how could Abraham be so small to pick at the price now that that's what he asked for? So Abraham pays the price. And both men walk away with what they hoped for. Ephraim gets what he wanted, a boatload of cash. And Abraham gets what he wants, a burial plot for Sarah. So besides the fact that Abraham was acting on faith, demonstrating that he wanted to have land in Canaan before the Lord gave it to him, why else would Abraham want to do that? Why would he want to purchase land as opposed to accepting initially the gift of the land for a temporary burial spot? Do you remember Genesis 14? No, I know you don't, but that's okay. That's why we have it in front of us so we can actually look at it. Abraham has met Melchizedek, the king of Salem. the king of Sodom wants to give Abraham a whole bunch of possessions. Abraham says to the king of Sodom, I have sworn to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread or a sandal thong or anything that is yours, for fear that you would say, I've made Abram rich. And I think in the back of Abraham's mind, even now, he's recognizing that the land is a gift from God, not from the Hittites. And so in order to prevent any information being miscommunicated in the future about who really owns it, Abraham says, I'll pay for it. I've sworn to the Lord God Most High that I will take nothing, lest someone say, I made Abraham rich. I provided this for Abraham. Abraham really understood, I think, by this point, that the land promise that was part of the Abrahamic covenant would not be fulfilled in his lifetime. Now, it's possible that it could happen instantaneously like this and in the next 20 years or so. But I think he understood that it wasn't going to happen in his lifetime unless there be any confusion as to the way in which Abraham would acquire the land. He sought to claim this one plot of ground for Sarah's grave, content to wait on the Lord for the rest. So the land is purchased. Sarah is buried. Verses 19 and 20. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field at Machpelah, facing Mamre, that is in Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded over to Abraham for a burial site by the sons of Heth. You caught that phrase, right? Deeded over. The official documents were signed. Abraham, this is now yours. And all the officials in the city gate agreed to this. It's kind of like the first minutes of the organization of Grace Bible Church. Here are the men who signed on that we sense this is what's right. And in the legal code of that day, the leaders of the city signed on and said, yes, Abraham has purchased this land and it now belongs to him. So Abraham buries Sarah. Gravesites can be hard on a family, can't they? Practically speaking. There is a finality to a graveside, totally different than a memorial service, even different than a funeral with a casket, because gravesides produce that kind of finality. And sometimes at gravesides, we've experienced it, we've seen it, that grief can be somewhat overwhelming. People weep. Abraham wept, we know that, because earlier on, he went to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her, verse 2. When I officiated at Jim's graveside at, interestingly enough, Valley Forge National Cemetery, is where the burial took place, one of Jim's niece had flown in from Michigan that morning and was flying out that evening. And she was kind of, I did not know this woman. I had not met her prior to this time. And we're all kind of around the burial place, and she's standing off to the side. Linda noticed it first, which is typical in our family, that she's going to notice what somebody has a need long before I do. But anyway, she notices that she's standing off to the side and goes over there, and she's weeping, literally just weeping tears. Because in the niece's mind, Jim was more than her uncle. He was even more than a father figure. He was a strong spiritual mentor and influence in her life. And now he's gone. She doesn't live anywhere near the rest of the family. She's out in Michigan, doesn't have a strong spiritual connection there. So who's going to help? So she's feeling that separation. So she weeps. We see that in Abraham as he mourns the loss of Sarah. And if we're honest, we see it for ourselves, because some of you know firsthand the loss of a mate, don't you? You know what that's like. And you walk home to the empty house. You sit around the empty table. And there's sadness because of the separation. We should probably pause just for a minute, take a little bit of a detour, and talk about the value and the significance for the believer of mourning and grief. Because sometimes, not often, but sometimes, Christianity gives the impression that if you really believed, then you'd have more joy than grief at a burial site. Good Christians don't really weep. How absurd is that, though, when you stop and think about it? Jesus wept at the grave of Lazarus, and he knew he was going to bring him back from the dead because he knew the devastating effects of sin, because death comes because of sin. I want to take you to another Old Testament passage. I love the book of Ecclesiastes, probably because I don't understand it. But I love reading it and just going, this causes me to pause and think. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, the wisdom of Solomon. A good name is better than a good ointment. The day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. It's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that's the end of every man. And the living takes it to heart. That's why you never miss a funeral. It reminds you of what's significant, what's important, what the brevity of life is like, and how to honor God while we're still alive. Sorrow, he says, is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. The mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. Grief, loss comes to all of us. We all grieve differently. I'm not trying to say there's a specific way that you grieve. I know there's books written on the process of grief and all that kind of stuff, and there's some validity to all of that. But the reality is we all grieve differently. We all grieve different process and how we handle that. But grief is normal. But as believers, we grieve differently. That's what Paul reminded us of in 1 Thessalonians, right? He said, I want to tell you about those who have already died. Because I know you're concerned about them. You're concerned about whether they're going to be with us in glory. Because as Paul preaches to this audience and talks about the coming of the Lord, they're expecting Jesus to come back in their lifetime, kind of like Abraham was initially expecting the promises to be fulfilled in his lifetime. And then some of their family members die. Well, what happens to them? And Paul says, I'm going to tell you what happens to them. You know, when the trump sounds, they're going. You know, they're going to go first. You're going to, we're all going to be joined together, and thus we'll be with the Lord forever. Therefore, he says at the end of that text in 1 Thessalonians 4, comfort one another with these words. Because we grieve differently. We grieve with hope. We grieve with hope. Death separates us. That's understandable from the loved one. But we grieve with hope. And the chapter really concludes with a reminder of that hope, because the field and the cave now belong to Abraham. He's no longer just a sojourner and a stranger in the land. He now has possession in the land. It has become more of a home. Before, it was a home based only on a promise. Now, it's still based on a promise, but it's a home based on possession as well. Who else gets buried there? Do you know your Old Testament history? I did have to look this up. I did not know this. I don't want to pretend that I went, oh, yeah, here's the people. Abraham gets buried there. Isaac gets buried there. Rebecca gets buried there. Jacob gets buried there. And Leah gets buried there. This is because this is now home. The land of Canaan will become their home based on the promise that God says, I've given you this land. From these boundaries to these boundaries, it's yours. I want to wrap up with a couple of thoughts. Two thoughts about the purchase of the land, and one thought about the promises yet to be realized, okay? We've already mentioned this briefly. First, in answer to the question, why would Abraham purchase a gravesite in Canaan? Why not return to Ur to bury Sarah? Because Abraham had come to realize that the promise of a land and a seed of blessing would not be realized in his lifetime, but by faith, he looked forward to its realization. Hebrews reminds us of that truth. Hebrews chapter 11, verses 13 to 16. All these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance, and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth, for those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they'd have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. And so there's both the context for Abraham, who's looking forward to a heavenly city. There's a context for us. For Abraham, it's looking forward to the promises being fulfilled for the specific land of Canaan. But there's also implied in that the heavenly city that's to come, the ultimately being in the presence of God. For us, on this side of the cross, we look forward to that heavenly city. We look forward to the time. This really is not our home. We have a lot of stuff here. You know, and we enjoy that stuff. And I think God desires for us to enjoy that stuff. He's given us those things to freely enjoy. Just don't get caught up in saying that's what defines my life. Because ultimately, our citizenship is in heaven. We're looking forward to being in the presence of Jesus with him forever. That's an evidence of faith because we don't have that yet. We're not in heaven. You and I have we have a little idea what heaven's going to be like, based on what we understand Scripture tells us. But the true immense glory and majesty of what's there in the presence of Jesus, we're clueless. So by faith, we look forward to the heavenly city because God's promised this is where you're going to be. You're going to be in my presence forever. I'm coming for you. I'm going to take you home. And if you're not alive, I'm still going to bring you home. That's my promise. So by faith, we live out that truth. So one of the questions we ask ourselves is, what does that faith look like in this time and age? How do we live by faith in light of the promised kingdom that we're looking for and not getting tied to the things of this earth, not allowing those things to define us? And we need to focus on the things that are eternal. But it's also interesting. So I think first point is we live by faith in light of the promise to come, heavenly city. Secondly, when Abraham purchased the land, he now, in essence, for lack of a better way to put it, becomes a citizen of Canaan. Before he was a sojourner. It's almost now he has this dual citizenship. Okay, he's in God's promised land, but now he owns land, so he has these responsibilities as a citizen. It's fascinating to me how Peter defines that for us today, i.e. our dual citizenship. We're looking forward to glory, but we live here. I think I put these verses in your outline. If not, I'll read them for you. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 to 17. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers. Okay, this is not really your home, even though you have a citizenship here. To abstain from fleshly lusts, which wage war, wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that the things in which they slander you as evildoers. So I paused right here as I was reading this. I thought, okay, think for a minute about how in the culture and world in which we live, believers are slandered, spoken evil of. Well, it doesn't take much, does it? So I put in your notes, we're called narrow-minded, prejudiced. We're actually called haters because we speak the truth and hold to the conviction. And this is just one example. that God created male and female, that your biological gender is determined by God at birth, better yet, it's determined in the womb. It's not determined by culture. It's not determined by how you feel. Now, I noticed this morning as I was looking at my notes, it says fell. It should say feel. But maybe there's a point there. That's not how you identify. And so we're slandered for that. So according to Peter, how are we to respond when we as believers are slandered by the culture in which we live? Notice what he says, that they may, on account of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. See, I think the tendency sometimes in the Christian community is we want to defend our beliefs. And please, don't misunderstand. We need to be able to defend our beliefs as to why we believe that. But often our desire to defend what we believe simply causes the slanderer to say, I'm right and you're wrong. So instead of defending our position, God simply wants us to serve. Submit yourselves to the Lord's sake, to every human institution, whether a king is the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God that by doing right, you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men. Do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bondslaves of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, and honor the king. We could spend a lot of time talking about the implications of this text for our culture today, for believers today living in this culture. But in essence, Peter is saying, our deeds matter. How we serve matters. Because ultimately, they're going to look at what we did, not what we said we believed. Finally, I know you're glad it's finally. Just as God made promises to Abraham, God makes promises to us regarding heaven and our eternal fellowship with him in eternity. Like the promises made to Abraham, these promises extend beyond this life, but they are just as certain as the promises made in the Abrahamic covenant because God does not lie. We have the promise of a new body. We have the promise of being in his presence forever. We have the promise of the joys and glories of heaven. We have the promise of a glorious reunion with those who have preceded. And all these things are made new in light of the future and the certainty of the promises of God. So Paul writes in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, therefore we do not lose heart. Though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory, far beyond all comparison, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. We look to the promises, and we're encouraged, not discouraged. I got 4 minutes, so you can either go early or you can ask questions I don't have answers for. Boris, I knew you'd be first. What?
Well, no, I just think it's wonderful. Last week, Rocky testified how Abraham so wisely looked forward to the vision of God as a